This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario. I'm joined this time with Joseph Simpson in Columbus, Ohio.
Hey, how's it going, Tim?
Good. It's going good. Cool. So, yeah, great to meet you. I've been, Joseph and I have been sort of following each other online for the last couple of months, I guess. Obviously, I've been paying a lot of attention to Vision Pro, which people seem to know. I spent the last year writing courses for Codico and, you know, bought a device myself early. But one of the things I discovered in my travels, looking for resources, trying to learn, you know, as I was building the courses, I needed to find other people, like-minded individuals who had, you know, were kind enough to post stuff online. And in the last boot camp I was doing, there was a lot of questions about, you know, immersive views and dealing with objects and things like that. And Joseph was kind enough to have already put together Step into Vision, explained on a couple of things about opening windows. That was one of the things, first things I noticed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I started sharing that with the students and they loved the content. So thanks for doing that, first of all.
Thanks,
and why don't you tell me a little bit about Step into Vision, what the idea is, where it came from, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so Step into Vision is a project that I launched, or maybe kind of soft launched, in August. It still hasn't really approached its full launch phase. There's going to be a lot more coming in 2025. But I had previously on my personal blog, I had been sharing code samples and demos across various platforms over the years. So at one point in 2021, I started a project called Canvatorium, where I called it my experimental design lab for spatial computing, where I was working in WebXR and Babylon.js primarily, but also some 3.js, some Plate Canvas, things like that. And just making UI concepts, making interesting things, and using it as a place to kind of explore. When I started getting into VisionOS development, I decided to repeat that same format, and I started a kind of an offshoot series called Canvatorium Visio. And throughout this year, I've done, I think, 43 labs on VRHermit.com. Just, you know, how do hover effects work, or, you know, how do you open and close windows, things like that. Kind of figuring out some of the 2D Swift UI stuff, how it looks in VisionOS, but also a lot of the 3D stuff. And I got to the point where I knew this was what I wanted to work on. So I decided to launch a new site called Step into Vision that is a bit more structured, that has its main core value proposition is the example code. So right now I've got the site kind of separated into articles, example code, labs, and resources. So articles are basically right now just a newsletter. I intend to do some longer form articles later, so maybe like a deep dive into gestures, like everything you wanted to know of gestures in one article, but I haven't really started that yet. The resources are just links to other stuff, so I've got your GitHub repo for the Awesome Vision, I forget the exact handle,
Awesome Vision OS,
awesome,
yeah.
Vision OS.
Resources,
yeah. So I've got that in there, just like a collection of like, hey, these are useful things that VisionOS developers will like. The labs are kind of continuing that tradition from Canvatorium of just giving me a place to play around and test ideas. But the example code is where the real work is happening. So that series that you alluded to, behind the scenes, I call it Window Garden. I think I did 6 example code posts in Windows, 6 in Volumes, and maybe 8 or 9 in Immersive Spaces. And this isn't dealing with the content of Windows and Volumes and Spaces. This is, how do I open and close these? How do I manage scene phase? How do I use placement, like default placement, to arrange my windows when I'm launching them, things like that. Apple has they haven't given us as much control as we want over windowing, but they have provided a lot of stuff that a lot of people aren't aware of. So that was the first series that I did in the example code section. And then I started branching out into gestures from there. So starting with the system gestures, like tap, double tap, long press, drag, magnify, scale gesture, things like that. So
are these under the category of spatial gestures or just gestures in general?
So these are Swift UI gestures that you can use something called targeted to any entity or target to a specific entity with a query. And then you can use those same system gestures that we use on like an iPhone app or an iPad app. You can also use those in Reality Kit in SwiftUI. So you can build some pretty cool stuff with it, and you can take your existing knowledge. They've got some coordinate space conversion stuff that can be helpful for, like, you know, I just tapped on the surface of a 3D object, you know, give me the location of that, as opposed to a regular tap gesture of like, this just told me what object I tapped.
Generic object, yeah, or entity, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so step in division started there. Right now I'm in the very early stages of kind of expanding from gestures into hand tracking. Mm-hmm. In various forms, so starting with anchor entities and then mixing in some AR kit on top of that for the hand tracking stuff. And then that will hopefully naturally segue into a longer series on the rest of AR kit, all the various data providers and things like that. So that's kind of what's on the roadmap now. But, you know, in the midst of that, also just playing around in the labs. So one of my favorite things so far has been the occlusion material. You can just make a material in Reality Composer Pro that has a single occlusion node that just feeds the output. And then if you're in an immersive space in mixed mode or in progressive mode, you can use that to see out of the virtual environment. And you can make some really fun stuff with it. So the first thing I did was, you know, put myself in a box. I made basically a floor and four walls and a ceiling. And then I put the occlusion material on a sphere, and I can just move it around and I can look outside the box from inside the
right,
box.
Right.
Things like that. It's just been a ton of fun to play with.
Let's take a step back, actually, because I'm kind of curious. I'm not really a JavaScript dude. I mean, I've done enough of it or whatever, but, mm-hmm. And you mentioned WebXR, right? So these are a couple of other areas that, you know, I haven't really paid attention to, but I've played around with them on the Vision Pro. Mm-hmm. So can you sort of give our listeners a bit of a background on Babylon.js and what's happening in the WebXR space?
Yeah, so WebXR is, it started as WebVR, 8 or 9 years ago. Hmm. It initially was a web VR, and then when they started adding AR features to it, initially there was briefly a web AR standard and a web VR standard, and it became clear right away that these could be the same standard. So they kind of went back to the drawing board. This is a W3C web standards body thing. So this is like an official part of web browsers. It is, hopefully no one from Apple's listening, it is the biggest disappointment of Apple Vision Pro. Their WebXR implementation is bad.
Really? Yeah.
It's very low quality. Scenes crash all the time. They came up with a pretty novel input system that kind of sucks compared to input on the rest of the platform. And I understand why. It's privacy preserving. They don't want to reveal eye tracking data directly to just any website. The implications of that are pretty staggering. But, you know, setting that specific feature aside, the rest of it is just, it doesn't feel great. For the first, you know, it was in beta, it was behind the feature flag at first, and
right,
that whole time we couldn't really reliably test our sites because they had messed up the color space so badly, so you couldn't tell how things were supposed to be rendered. I'm very hopeful that WebXR will get better, but it's going to take time, and the way that Apple rolls out Safari updates, it seems like we'll get new features next year. WebXR in general, it's kind of my first love in spatial computing and VR development. I had done some Unity and some Unreal Engine stuff. When it became clear to me that I wasn't going to do game development, I set that stuff aside. Those are like very heavy duty tools for the types of user interfaces I want to make. So Babylon.js is a 3D graphics thing, basically a JavaScript powered 3D graphics engine. It technically is a game engine or can function as a game engine, but you can also just make simple 3D presentations. It will work in WebXR, but that's not its primary use. It has WebXR as a feature, it's not exclusively a WebXR thing. So you can make, you know, a pretty stunning data visualization that can run on your phone. It is not owned by Microsoft, but it is maintained by a core team of Microsoft employees. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they are dedicated to a certain backwards compatibility that you don't see anywhere else in WebXR or 3D graphics. So the other things out there in the same space would be like 3JS and A-Frame, and then one of my favorites, Play Canvas, which is kind of a game engine similar to Unity, but built in web tech and is just tiny in comparison. You can make some phenomenal stuff with it. It was like, oh, this took almost no work at all.
Cool.
Yeah, I love that space, but I'm not doing a lot in it right now. I'm doing a few client projects here and there, but I'm not pouring a lot of creativity in it right now because the headset that I want to spend my time at has the worst experience for it. So I think if Apple catches up a little bit and they solve the input thing, then WebXR could be one of the best ways, particularly for brands and companies, to build something for spatial computing without having to do the whole App Store thing. Or also for just temporary experiences. Like, I don't want to publish something to a store that only needs to be up for an event.
That's true. There seems to be, this happens in the platform. It happened on iPad. I remember doing this kind of stuff. I've even done a few apps which were basically a shell that had presented a web view, and then you just fed it content, either built into the bundle, or you went to a site and got it. And yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing. So I guess what you're saying is you could, in theory, build a web experience and have it presented. I mean, like, you know, we can look at spatial photos now because they've added that support in Safari on a web browser. It's not quite it's not a point and click solution yet, but yeah. And you're right. I did look at WebXR. I mean, I hadn't really paid attention to it either because I got out of 3D for a long time. Mm-hmm. And obviously when it came out and it started surfacing that the feature flag was there, I turned it on and went and found some sites. And I remember when I went to the developer lab in August of 2023, they suggested we look at a few WebXR things, and there was things that weren't working. And I mean, that was very early days. I mean, the immersive videos weren't even working. I think you had to log into the device, and then we couldn't log into them because they were lab devices. But interesting. So the end question to the WebXR piece is, it's something that we can think about in the future in terms of being a way to present content that doesn't need to be an app, like you said. Mm-hmm. Because like I said, there's a bunch of apps on the App Store that have one purpose, and that's to sort of show an immersive video, Immersive India, Immersive London, those kind of things, you know, which aren't, I don't know if they're thinking down the road to have them load up different experiences there's been a lot of apps in the early iOS days which were template apps that you could just, you know, change the content and make a new app out of, right? Sort of. Okay, let's go back to, so I did, Joseph sent me his sort of, I guess, blog, which you talked about what's the best career for you. And that's something, it's interesting because that's a topic I had to look at about 10 years ago with my own company. You know, what is it I want to do with my life, right? Or what is it that makes me happy, and why should I continue to do it? So you mentioned, you talked about, I've sort of forgotten the name already, of the other experience, because you were dealing with VR on another platform. I'm curious how you got to where you are today. I mean, just as a side note here, I also started in FileMaker Pro. Well before the web came along. Like, I was, you know, doing FileMaker Pro. I mean, that's how I got into being a developer. Played around with HyperCard in the early days, just, you know, fiddled around with this and that. But it was the FileMaker Pro at work that kind of got me going on developing, and then eventually discovered PHP, like you mentioned. So I'm kind of curious. So why don't you give us a little backstory on you, how you got from FileMaker Pro to being a developer.
Sure. So I guess as a background, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and unlike all of my peers who have ever been on a podcast and given this talk, I didn't grow up with computers. I didn't write code out of magazines and, you know, learn BASIC or anything. Like, I had nothing to do with any of that. I read books and smoked cigarettes when I was 15 and was too cool for that kind of stuff. Yeah. So I didn't really get into computing in general, but programming I didn't even consider it an option of something that I could do for work until around 2011. By that point, I'd done various dead-end jobs over the years, and it was kind of clear.
What was your career path like? What did you do? I guess you didn't do computer science, is what you're saying, right?
No college background, no formal education. Basically, from high school to, I mean, if you want to get serious, I went from high school to poverty to alcoholism to spiraling out of control for several years. So I had a bit of an arrested development phase where didn't really grow up as a person until 2010, 2011. And it was in 2010, actually it was in 2008 that I made this friend, someone from Alcoholics Anonymous that I became friends with. We would hang out couple times a month, get coffee, hang out and talk, stuff like that. And he ran an IT company that did some software development. They did some FileMaker development, they did some WordPress stuff, and they also provided IT services. And in 2011, I basically just started pestering him. I guess to preface that, him and a couple other people had really taken an interest in me of like, you can't just keep working dead-end jobs. Like, you're way smarter than you give yourself credit for. I didn't know how to see that back then. I had always operated any of this option, and I was basically set out to be a failure. And this friend thought different, and he encouraged me a lot. So he got me reading a lot of books. He kind of like kickstarted my brain. And once my brain was actually fired on and activated, I started like, I can't just go to work and do these boring things every day. And I started pestering him, like, hey, can I have a job? And he's like, well, I don't know, maybe, you know, we'll talk about it someday. And it finally came down to his mother had been helping him with some of the business admin stuff, like, you know, cashing all the checks for the IT business, sending out invoices, running the payroll, stuff like that. And she wanted to step away from it. So we made a deal that I would come on to do all of the administrative stuff for the business, and then they would train me in FileMaker Pro development. So that was the original deal. And I think probably one of the reasons I'm not going to mention his name, because I think probably we were in like labor violations. Like, I was definitely not making minimum wage the first couple of months, because I was working 60, 70 hours a week to try to catch up to the other guys. But it took me, you know, 6 months of studying, learning about databases. I had never really thought about making software, so I didn't know anything about the rest of software development. But we made a lot of stuff for political campaigns, for nonprofits, lobbyists, lawyers, a lot of like less tangible stuff. So I wasn't making inventory systems or POSs or anything like that.
Right. Okay.
A lot of CRM type of things, mailing lists. So did a lot of that in FileMaker Pro, and I think it was probably a full year into it before I really started to say, oh yeah, I'm actually a developer now. And at some point we hired somebody else to do all the administrative stuff, and I became a full-time developer. I got certified and all the certifications at the time. And I went pretty fast. I went from no knowledge, no abilities to, you know, certified developer handling projects on my own. I think in about 2 years. And then I ended up leaving that company to work for another development shop out of St. Louis. And I grew a ton there. Very, very competent team. And I had some technical skills, and that's where I learned more interpersonal skills. At my previous job, I had always just been, here's the work, you go do it, we'll go take it back to the customers. And that was the first place where I really got to interface with customers on, you know, every project. I really got to manage the relationship. And the owner of that company jokes around that he provided such a good workplace that the only path forward that I could see for myself was to leave, because the only way up was to make a company of my own. So I worked there for about a year and a half and started Radical Application Development.
So in these, what kind of tools and systems were you working with? Was it Mac, Windows?
Started with Windows, just because that's what we use at the IT company. Yeah. And then I did a couple projects on Mac. FileMaker is owned by Apple.
Right. Used to be Claris, yeah.
Yeah, it actually is Claris again. They turned into FileMaker for several years, and then they turned back into Claris 3 or 4 years ago.
So. Yeah.
I started on Windows, and then when I took that job at the second company, they sent me a MacBook Pro, the best MacBook Pro, that 2014, 2015 era model before the touch bar. So that was my first, like, okay, I'm going to really learn Mac OS. And now it took me a month or two to become productive on it, but there was no going back to Windows after that. Like, I still know my way around Windows, but.
Were you doing Xcode at that point in time, or are you still doing like PHP stuff?
That was still FileMaker. And then once I branched out on my own Radical App Dev, that was the year that Swift came out. And I was very interested in, I guess one of the reasons I started my company is the idea behind it was I was going to use my FileMaker consulting skills to kind of bootstrap another business to do app development.
Right.
And I dove into Swift, and making the jump from FileMaker Pro to Swift and CoreData and CloudKit, there's a very large chasm in skill sets between those two, and I had a lot to learn. I jumped way too far in and just failed consistently for 6 or 7 months. I had several broken, I had several very beautiful but architecturally broken apps at that point. And a friend of mine suggested, why don't you try out game development? That he had done what was then RayWenderlich.com. They had a course on SpriteKit. Mm-hmm. And so he sent me that, and I spent a couple weekends looking at that and said, okay, this makes a little bit more sense. A lot easier to grok. There's no data to manage. There's no syncing to deal with. I'm just, you know, putting pixels on screen, putting groks on screen, and reading input and doing stuff. So I made my first app. It wasn't a very good app, but it was my first one. It's called Random Arrow. And at the time, there was this news story about some huge consulting company who was hired to do a line management app on an iPad. And it was basically just a random number generator that would point an arrow left or right and tell people what line to get into. So I took that idea and basically, you know, I made an app called Random Arrow, where you would basically just have to swipe on the screen at the direction the arrow was pointing. So an arrow would show up, you'd have to swipe that way. And at first it sounded very easy, but after a while they would start spinning in from different directions. It would pop in, you know, maybe it'd come in from this way, but it's pointing that way. Okay. Things like that.
Cognitively trick people, right?
Yeah. And it was the type of app that you could do, you kind of play with while you're listening to a podcast or an audiobook. Sure. It wasn't meant to take your full attention. Like I said, it was a very stupid idea, but it was a big achievement for me because it was my first real success in development outside of FileMaker, and it kind of whet my appetite for the type of work, but also kind of confirmed to me that, oh, you are actually capable of learning rapidly and building something when you set your mind to it. And somehow that Swift, that 2D Sprite Kit Swift game led immediately into a, you know, $60,000 PHP project.
Oh, really?
Don't know how those two connected, but that's what came next. So, you know, I guess I'm a better salesman than a developer. I just sold the project and learned PHP as I went, and that system is still up and running. I still maintain it.
So that's a good question. There's something, one of the challenges that I mean, I went to an entrepreneurial group back in early days of my business and learned a bit about how to focus on things. But one of the challenges that was right there at the very beginning is, how do you charge for your effort? I mean, you know, I've been keeping track of my time for, I don't know how many years, like 20 years now, and so and I have a good sense when I'm developing a PHP site, for example. Somebody comes in with an app idea, I can kind of break it down in terms of like what I think of man hours and come up with a ballpark figure, right? And it's always low. Right. It's always development always takes longer than you think it's going to take, you know, because there's always, you know, there's all kinds of different slowdowns and stuff like that. But so I'm curious, like, so you threw out a number there, $60,000. How did you know that would be a reasonable scope for that project? Or is that just based on how it ended up being?
So I knew the scope of the project in terms of what we were trying to build. So we had an existing thing that had been built 15, 20 years earlier that I was replacing. So, and I'd already built the FileMaker aspect of it. So it was basically the rest of it that needed to be built. It wasn't a trivial app. It was probably 50 different screens on this PHP app. Like, it was a pretty big problem space. But once I knew that once I had figured out the data flow, how to get data into the app, how to get data out of the app, you know, doing form validation, all that stuff, I knew that I would be able to do it.
Is that something you did by yourself, or did you hire people to help, or?
I just learned it as I went. So.
Okay.
I wish I had ChatGPT, but
we all learn that way, by the way. I mean, as you know, I'm an author for Ray Wunderlich, which you mentioned, which is now Codico, and I can tell you some of the behind the scenes conversations is that, you know, you pick up a subject matter and you become the expert on it, but to become the expert on it, you have to sort of figure it out. At the beginning, we don't know really all the answers. We kind of figure them out as we go.
Yeah. That's definitely my experience with Step Into Vision. It's just I'm sometimes publishing stuff as I learn it.
Sure, of course, yeah.
But yeah, the pricing thing, the one thing that I took from my FileMaker career that I've kind of brought into the rest of my career is that I intentionally charge high prices. Mm-hmm. And I tell people that up front when a new customer comes to me, with, you know, we hop into a Zoom or Teams Teams meeting, within 30 seconds, I'm telling them, I'm going to be one of the more expensive people you're working with, and you're going to pay me up front. If either of those scare you, now's the time to end the conversation. And that gets rid of 9 out of 10 customers.
That's a super, super good bit of advice. And I've tried to do that myself. And I know, because one of my coaches back in the day said, pick a number that scares the hell out of you and double it. Right. And you're right. I mean, like, you know, I was running a managed services IT job, and if I wanted to support Windows, that's a cash cow. That's a license to print money if you want to support Windows. But it's drudgery and it's horrible work and it doesn't pay very well. So I don't do it anymore. And that's part of my decision on why I don't do Windows anymore is because of that decision I made, that, you know, mm-hmm. I need to put myself in a place where I'm doing the best work that I can and people are getting the best out of me that they can, and I'm charging for it. Mm-hmm. Right.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's a good philosophy.
Yeah,
for sure.
It scares people away. And the people in my experience, on the rare occasion where I have taken someone on this price conscience, those are the projects that go awry.
Right.
When someone doesn't balk at price at all, when you're dealing with the stakeholder directly, like the business owner or somebody who's actually in charge of the budget, then they know what they're getting into. I suppose it can backfire if you're working for a large enterprise company where they have enterprise spending, but the person making the decision isn't the user. So it's just the kind of thing that has worked well for me because I'm working with owners of small businesses. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if I went to, I don't know, Nike or something, I probably wouldn't use the same approach to them.
It's a good bit of advice, and I'm glad you talked about that because I do see a lot of young developers who want to get into freelancing and you know, they leave their day job to go into to become an indie developer, and I'm looking at them going like, what? You know,
that's the other thing. I don't let anybody call me an indie developer or a freelancer. They're hiring a company that provides a service.
Yeah.
And I make that clear to my customers.
Yeah, 100%. And you know, like I've built some pretty big apps too, but I didn't do them by myself. I mean, like, you know, if I needed, like when I first got into Objective-C app development, I hired a guy out of Calgary who was, had been doing it for years because I could give him the heavy lifting work to do. And then that way I could manage the job and look and feel and deal with the customer on the relationship and that kind of stuff. And he did the heavy lifting on the mechanics behind the app. Right. So,
That would definitely be the smarter thing to do. I just love digging into every problem myself. And I'm definitely trying to do that more with VisionOS. Like I want to touch every part of VisionOS and RealityKit, but I don't want to become an expert in any of them. So, you know, I don't want to write the book or the chapter for Codico on particle emitters. Right. Somebody's going to write like the epic particle system book at some point, but it's not going to be me. But I'm going to know, you know, the 90% of that is we're going to use the most, or the 10% of that we're going to use 90% of the time.
Yeah, I read a book by an author named Edward De Bono called Lateral Thinking back when I was in university. And one of the things I learned from him was the world needs generalists, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many specialists out there. I'm a general, as you can see, I have a lot of general knowledge behind me, right? I'm the same way. I don't want to be stuck in being the guy who makes all the blue buttons all day long, right? Yeah. Or the expert on making blue buttons. I'd rather know how to make a blue button and move on to hand tracking or something like that, right? And so I totally get it. And your site makes more sense to me now because you kind of sort of you hit on the points that I'm interested in, but I don't have time to do. That's why I like going to Step Into Vision because I can go get a quick, you know, run through your lab, step through the code, you know, try my own hand at it, change things as I need them to be. And then I've now picked up this new skill and I can pass it on to students or other people who are interested in that. And that's cool. I do want to ask you, so we talked a bit about privacy and Apple and their approach to it. And I get it. I work for Apple and I appreciate that Apple's protecting us from ourselves is what they're doing. Right.
A lot of times. Yeah.
And I've been around the internet for long enough to know that there's so many bad actors out there. You just have to be careful. But the eye tracking caught my attention because I saw a post the other day. So as we talk, like last week, not even a full 7 days ago, Google and Samsung announced their new headset device, which for me is great news because it validates the work you and I are doing on Vision Pro, but because it validates the platform. But it also It's Android. Android has a different approach, or Google has a different approach to things. I don't get me wrong. They are still focused on security and privacy, I'm sure, just like Apple is. But Apple's always been accused of having a walled garden, right? So one of the things we don't have access as Vision Pro developers right now is we don't have access to eye tracking. We can't get that data. And you mentioned when you were talking about it earlier. So I'm curious, there was a post the other day that came out that said that you can have access to eye tracking on the Android XR devices, right? I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, so it's still behind a permission flag. The user still has to grant it. But yeah, it's as far as I can tell, any Android developer, maybe they'll have some kind of vetting process for that. I don't know. But it seemed from that article that's like, oh, yeah, just request it and you have to add this prompt to your app and then you're good to go. And good luck, everybody. I'm not going to be doing that.
Yeah, well, it's similar to the camera access, like the front-facing cameras and stuff like that. I mean, I was a little disappointed. Because my FileMaker, my PHP experience is also in building inventory systems, right? So one of the things I would love to be able to do is have barcode or QR code scanning capability. Because if you're in a giant warehouse and you want to know where you put that box, it'd be super nice to be able to walk along with a Vision Pro on and look at a barcode and go, oh, it's over there. Or build you a map that you could follow to get to it. But these are all things we don't have access to on Vision Pro yet. But I have a feeling that my gut feeling is we don't have access to these frameworks yet. We don't have access to eye tracking either. But I'm sure that at some point in the future, based on influences from other companies and other apps that are built for other platforms, we may, in fact, get these things at some point in the future, right?
Probably. Although I'm not hoping that happens. I hope that it doesn't happen. Honestly, I'm on the other side of that. I recognize how it can be useful, but I've been in the XR world this whole time and listening to other podcasts and reading articles about the type of things that can be inferred with eye tracking data. It goes way beyond anything. This is not like your browsing history. With a very tiny sample of data, your sexuality can be inferred.
Really?
If you're in a country where that, you know, it's against law to be homosexual, that could get you killed.
Wow, yeah.
The stakes are very, very different.
That's an interesting point,
with biometric data in general. Another example is, I haven't seen an exact example of this, but what if there's a way to infer if someone is ovulating and then all of a sudden, maybe didn't have a baby when the eye tracking data suggested they should have?
Right.
That could
so you don't want to be sending like the websites where they send people information about baby clothes, not realizing that, they were using their credit card to buy books on information about that stuff. But that you're right. Like there was a change in their life when they didn't reach that goal.
So there are plenty of legitimate use cases for it, but I don't want it to be like those prompts that we get in Apple Vision Pro now. Do you want to grant access to hand tracking? And most people don't even think twice about it. I don't want it to become normalized where we just give away some incredibly personal data to Tim's app. I just downloaded. I don't know him. I just thought this inventory app would be cool. And Tim may be cool, but he also may have sold his app 6 months later to someone who is collecting all of that eye tracking data.
Yeah, it's interesting. I worked in banking, and well, just two things. One is like I don't know if for people driving at home, if they've seen the little checkbox on a website that says, "Are you human?" What they're doing is they're watching the cursor movement. If the cursor goes directly to the box, you're probably an AI. But if you kind of grab the mouse and you kind of wander over there, they look at how you move from where the cursor is to where the box is and determine whether or not you're a human being or not. And having worked in banking, how you hold your phone, not all banks do this, but how you hold your phone can determine whether or not you're a human being or not too.
Nice.
Yeah. So you raise a perfect example point on, I hadn't thought about that, but thanks for raising that about, what this data can be used for beyond, convenience. And I always say to people, the enemy of security is convenience and the enemy of convenience is security, like it's just, they don't belong in the same box or same category. That's cool. Oh, that's an interesting point. So what, just on the other side of the other part of that question, what do you think about Android entering into the VR technology, VR headset space?
I've got mixed feelings about it. it was kind of inevitable that they would re-enter the space. I'm not interested in developing for Android XR.
Yeah, me either.
at all. One, I don't particularly enjoy Android development, but two, I had thrown myself into Google's last VR initiative called Daydream. Okay. And I spent a year and a half making stuff for the Daydream platform only to have them just cancel the entire project and close it down. So
wow.
I won't be using Google's development tools for anything for the rest of my career. Just not interested. Even if the next gold rush is over there and people are making millions, I'd rather not make those millions than work with Google's tools. So now, as a consumer, that doesn't mean it won't be an interesting device. I know several friends who are kind of all in the Samsung ecosystem the way that I'm all in the Apple ecosystem. So maybe one of them will get the headset and I'll try it out. But I definitely won't be developing for it outside of WebXR. You know, maybe someday I'll get one to just test and validate my WebXR apps and experiences on it. But as far as shipping to the Play Store, things like that, no interest.
Yeah.
I respect Samsung a lot as a company, and I wish they had gone the Meta Horizon route rather than the Google Android XR route.
Okay. Well, how do you have a Meta device now, or you had one?
Yeah, I have five of them. So,
what do you think about Meta as a platform, and how does Meta in general compare to Vision Pro? Like, but what do you think about Meta first of all, and then second part of the question is, is it apples and oranges, right?
No, they're both approaching the same destination from different directions and different origins. So Apple is showing up with a general purpose computing device that can do a little bit of VR in a very light sense. Mm-hmm. Immersive video is impressive, like it's high quality, but it's not anything different that we've been able to do in VR for a decade, really. You know, in 2018, you could buy a $200 Oculus Go that could do immersive video and 360 video, not as high fidelity and as high resolution as these ones, but still pretty convincing. Like the Meta is coming at it. When they were still Oculus, they had this big picture dream of making a computing platform. And as they slowly morphed from Oculus into focusing on the Quest line, they turned more and more into a gaming console. It was clear that that's where the money is today, is VR gaming. So that's kind of where they put all their effort. And they shut down a lot of projects. You know, at one point they had a VR sculpting app called Medium that sold off to Adobe. They had a VR painting app. They had a video publishing platform, a ton of productivity stuff. And they slowly phased all that out in favor of basically becoming a game console that you wear in your head. So the Quest 1 and 2 in particular really focused in that direction of just becoming a really good self-contained VR gaming console. With Quest 3, they have finally started branching back out into general purpose computing. So the Quest UI, it's built on Android, but it's their own fork of Android, and they've got their own windowing system that, until relatively recently, has been very primitive. It's, you know, a couple of system apps, like a browser and an app store, things like that, but there haven't really been a way to do third-party apps there. They've opened up access to that, and they've also rebuilt their windowing system to be more a little bit more customizable when you have multiple windows floating around you and things like that. So the software standpoint there, they've got some interesting things going on, but when you show up on Vision OS, you don't just get windows and volumes and things like that and Swift UI. You get Event Kit, you get Health Kit, you get, you know, tons and tons of APIs from the rest of this platform that Meta doesn't have, that just aren't baked into the open standard of Android. So they'd have to reinvent all of the services. So they're not quite comparable on the general computing side, and they're not quite comparable on the VR side. I use them both daily. For years, I had done some work in VR in Quest, and now I don't even think about it. I do all my work in Apple Vision Pro, or just not in XR at all. And then I use my Quest for WebXR development and testing and fitness and gaming. And for me, it's kind of, they're suited for such different things at this point. Like I work out in VR every day. There's an app called Supernatural on Quest, and it's very physically active. You're moving around, you're swiping these huge bats, or you're doing a boxing workout. You know, it works because the Quest is so comfortable and so light, and I've got it customized for workouts.
You're not worried about it falling off your head,
for example.
It would
be way too heavy. This would not stay on my head for one of those moves, let alone a half an hour of them. And then I would also probably, you know, drop it or run into something and shatter this very expensive screen. So
while you got that in your hand, is that the Apple dual band strap?
Yeah, I use that default dual band. The scrunchie, whatever it's called.
Solo knit, this one.
Yeah, the one they want in the commercials, I did not think was comfortable.
Yeah,
I've tried various straps like that. They just did not work for me.
Yeah, the Anapro, what I like about this one is it actually sits on the top of my forehead, right? And it's a lot more, less pressure on my face. And it's funny because I went to my eye doctor to check my prescription because I have when I bought my Vision Pro, I had to go to an American company and get a LensCrafters and get a super prescription the day I picked up my Vision Pro. Because to buy the Zeiss inserts, I had to use an American optometrist, right? But I went to so I took this with me to my optometrist yesterday in Canada here, right? But I took off the Anapro and I put the old, you know, Spigen top strap on, and it, you know, they're comparable in terms of like comfort and fit and that kind of stuff. But yeah, I think that it's funny. I sat down and watched a bunch of TV shows last night, and then I ended up watching a movie called Beautiful Boy, which is not the point of this subject, but I realize as I'm watching a movie and I'm 2 hours into a movie that I've been wearing the Vision Pro for 2 hours and not thought about wearing the Vision Pro. I mean, like that's to me, I'm curious, like you mentioned you use these things every day. I can't imagine doing a workout on this. Mind you, I have a stationary bike, so I watch Disney shows while I'm on the stationary bike. But how do you use your Vision Pro? Do you use it as a computer? Like, do you think of it as a computer? Like, I sit at my kitchen table with my Vision Pro on with the widescreen, and I work. So I can work with Xcode with the computer on my lap, or I can work with Xcode with the Vision Pro on. How do you use it as a computing device?
So when I'm working in Xcode, I will use it with the Mac Virtual Display.
Right.
And I would use it either... So I don't really sit at a desk. I'm not.
Yeah, you're at a standing desk right now. We should probably tell listeners at home. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not really ergonomically capable of sitting in a chair for long periods of time. What I can do is I can use a standing desk, or I can sit on the floor. So I don't know if I can tilt back, but I have a very small little table back there, and I can sit on the floor with the Apple Vision Pro and the laptop on the table. That's very comfortable.
Like cross-legged or legs out straight? Okay.
Cross-legged. The other thing I will do is I've got a kind of a reclining sofa in the other room, and I will kind of kick back there, throw the laptop on my lap, and then throw the virtual screen up in the air. So one of the things I like about Apple Vision Pro in particular, but you know, other headsets as well, is the ability to detach the screen from the laptop, but I can take it anywhere. Like, obviously I could have a big, huge screen on my desk and position it anywhere and have the laptop anywhere, but then that is only in this room. I can take that same setup with me and go anywhere in the house or leave and go somewhere else. So despite the weight of the device, it is very heavy compared to other headsets. I can get into a more ergonomic position, into a lot of different positions as well, which I think is probably best for me. So I never spend too long in one place, maybe an hour or two at the standing desk, an hour or two on the floor, and things like that. So
I think everything's relative. Like, I don't know if you can see over my shoulder there. I used to be a goaltender, so I would wear, my goalie masks are heavier than the Vision Pro. So, and I would wear those for 3-4 hours at a time, right? So
wow. I got a little used to, so the Quest, in the Quest product line, they went from Oculus Go to Quest 1, which was a very heavy, uncomfortable headset. And then Quest 2 was this huge breath of air. It was much lighter, much more customizable, and a really nice strap design. And that was the official headset for 3 years. So I just got really used to that. And then Quest 3 came out, and it's roughly the same weight, but a little bit closer to you, so it's got even more balance. So I got a little spoiled with these all-in-one headsets. They were pretty light and comfortable. And then Apple Vision Pro comes out, and it's like, wow, this is like 200 grams heavier than what I'm used to.
Right. Yeah.
And the battery is not even inside it.
So have you ever tried the HTC Vive? I've seen those, but I've never tried them. How do they fit into the weight-wise comparison?
I'm not sure about their current models. The original one that I had in 2017 was, because these plug into a PC, so their VR stuff is just the optics and screen. So those are super light. Now that you do have a big chunky cable coming off of you, so I think I don't know the exact grams, but it's got to be half the weight, maybe even even less of a standalone headset because you don't need a whole computer in there. You have some display tech and some lenses. The original Rift was even lighter and more comfortable than the Vive, although it had some weird tracking issues. And the PSVR, as far as if we're talking about comfort, we got to mention the PSVR, the PlayStation VR.
Yeah.
The second gen is okay. The first gen was, it's like, am I wearing anything? Like, you could easily spend 5 hours in there without
really
any notice that you were even wearing it. Yeah, it was incredible.
Yeah, my granddaughter has one of those. I never actually tried it, but I saw them try it before they bought it, they tried it at a fan expo in Toronto here. One of my friends, I think it's Steve Lipton, pointed out that this is the worst Vision Pro we're going to have.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm complaining about it, but yeah, I love it. I use it every day.
Yeah.
I'm complaining about it because I want them to improve it, not because I want them to stop.
So that's a good question. So I probably use mine somewhere between on a light day, I might use it for like, you know, an hour or so, but I'm always watching I watch, you know, Disney Plus on it. I watch Apple TV shows on it. Mm-hmm. And I work in Xcode for 3-4 hour stretches on it. Right. So, what's your average daily use? Do you know?
I'd say probably 2 to 3 hours a day. I'd say I get a good session in it. So I'm a big coffee drinker. I start my day with a pot of coffee and some development, and I do my best work in that 2 or 3 hours after I first wake up. Vision Pro isn't allowed in that space because coffee puts off steam, and I don't know if y'all notice, but those are vents, and I don't mm-hmm. want to fill my Apple Vision Pro with steam.
Okay.
So I don't want to drink coffee while I'm wearing it. So the first 2 or 3 hours of the day, I don't even touch it. Maybe I'll put it on, like quickly test a hand tracking thing and then take mm-hmm. it off. But, so it hasn't really made it into that most vital part of the day. I did experiment over the summer, like maybe I'll switch to iced coffee, but it's just, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Again, not sponsored by these guys, but I switched over to this charging dock. I don't know if you've seen mm-hmm. this one.
I've seen it online. I haven't actually
and it's got
one.
The battery thing here, right? But mm-hmm. so I put my laptop as a and I carry this upstairs to the kitchen, and so my Vision Pro is usually not far from me, is my point, right? So even so, I can just pop it on and use it. And
I keep mine on my desk in my office, but I want one of those little tea trays they have at the Apple Store where they bring you out your Apple Vision
yeah.
Pro in this nice
yeah.
little tray.
Well, this is very close to it. I mean, like, let me just take the device off so you can see that it's kind of mm-hmm. same sort of idea, right?
Yeah, it just kind of fits into it.
But it's got the USB port on the back, so when I plug it in, the battery charges, right? So mm-hmm. that's kind of cool. Yeah, and behind me, I printed off, well, you can't see it, but I printed off Kristen Sillig's holder, but I was carrying it in the travel case, which is basically mm-hmm. like two of those trays, like you said, at the Apple Store, right?
Yeah.
Actually, I saw somebody was making those, I think maybe on Etsy. Yeah, that guy, yeah.
It's a pretty big travel case.
Yeah, well, and I bought a smaller one for, I think it was for a Vive or something like that. There's pretty much room for the Vision Pro without the Ana Pro on top and the battery, and that's about it. And that's great for travel, fits in a backpack. Because I went to Beijing with that travel case in a backpack, mm-hmm. and it was horrible on the plane
yeah,
trying to get in and out
backpack.
Of it. Yeah. So that's one thing about it. I mean, and people have wrapped their Vision Pros in towels, and I just shudder to think, you know?
Yeah. Mine is, like, I know people posted photos with cracks in them or scratches all over
yeah.
the display. Mine, you know, I replaced the, or I washed the facial interface a couple of times mm-hmm. a month, but it looks brand new. Like,
yeah.
I polish it every couple of days. I take it apart and clean it.
Yeah, I got the I don't know what this material is, but this way I don't have to worry about touching it, and other than cleaning where the cameras are, right? But mm-hmm. But I can't put I can't put the cover on anymore, so
yeah,
it doesn't fit. It's
yeah.
too big.
I've been a little selfish with it, honestly. I'm a member of the local VR meetup, VR Columbus, and when I first got it, they're like, "Oh, are you gonna bring your headset?" I'm like, no.
Really?
I'm not going to do that. Like, you guys can't try my Apple Vision Pro. Go to the Apple Store, book a demo.
Oh, I'm completely the opposite. I printed out a little carry case for my lenses so I can take them out, and I carry both the adjust fit thingies. Use a thicker one when you're wearing lenses because you have to move the thing away from your face. But yeah, I'll let people borrow mine all the time. Yeah, I don't have a problem doing that. But I have taken it to a meetup, and nobody's asked to try it, so
yeah.
Oh, well.
That's one thing I do like about the Quest platform a little bit more is it accommodates glasses. Mm. So anybody can just try it rather than, oh, I need to get the right prescription inserts. So when I was doing demos, I'm still kind of involved in the FileMaker world. And we went to Claris Engage in February, right after the Apple Vision Pro came out. And it was hosted on an Apple Canvas in Austin. And I showed up at Apple the week after Apple Vision Pro launched with an Oculus Quest or Meta Quest, and did demos to the CEO of Claris and tons of other executives there. And like, they were more excited about what we had built in WebXR than Apple Vision Pro at the time. I was like, come on, guys.
Cool. All right, well, I want to switch over to the other part of the show where I sort of just ask you the peeling back the onion questions.
Sure.
So if you're comfortable and ready to go, we can dig in. I normally ask people if they're seated comfortably, but no, you're standing. So if you're ready to go, we can dig into those.
Sure.
All right. So the first question is, this is based on the Marcel Proust question. This is the first question they ask is, what is your motto? What drives you?
One day at a time.
One day at a time. Okay, cool.
And I think 15% of your audience will nod along with that, know what that means.
Yeah, I think they will. What's your favorite occupation?
Favorite occupation? Definitely author for Step Into Vision and developer. I don't know, I've never thought about that one. I would say developer.
Okay, cool. And who are your heroes in real life?
In real life, I was immediately reaching for historical figures.
That's fine.
Okay, Marcus Aurelius, Marcus Tullius Cicero, people like that. I did a lot of, there was that joke going around last year, like, how often do you think about the Roman Empire? I spent 6 or 7 years reading everything I could about the Roman Empire. So.
Cool. So what in particular, well, you mentioned Marcus Aurelius at first, so what's significant about him?
He was a Stoic philosopher.
Okay.
Stoicism has done a lot for me in terms of emotional management and deciding how I want to react to situations and kind of learning how to be more in control of myself as an individual. So.
Cool. What's your favorite word?
Banana.
Banana. Why is that?
Just it's a great
sound
word.
Feel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a nice round word. It's got all those loops and curves and stuff. It's a great word.
All right. So what is the best sandwich?
Best sandwich. So it's a little complicated. You need some whole wheat bread, and you can make either an aioli or you can use mayo if you don't have aioli, and mix in a little bit of sriracha and cinnamon to make a nice little sriracha cinnamon aioli, and then saute a piece of ham and saute, cut up some Granny Smith apples, saute those with a little bit of flour and sugar and cinnamon, throw those on the ham, throw that on the sandwich. Fantastic.
Heaven, right? Okay, mm-hmm. Cool. Apples or oranges?
Apples. Don't care for oranges.
Can you put peanut butter on an apple? Is that why? Or
I don't like the texture of oranges. I like orange juice, but I don't like the texture of oranges.
Okay. What's your favorite action movie?
Favorite action movie? Does The Matrix count?
Yeah.
There's a lot of action in there. Or, maybe let me update that. The first John Wick movie.
Oh, okay. All right. Whoa. Is that the only response I can give to that? Where would you most like to live?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm very much a hobbit. Like, I don't like to leave the Shire, so I don't really have aspirations or dreams of living somewhere else.
Okay, cool. Cats or dogs?
So I love cats, but I'm also allergic to them, so I can't have them. Mm. And I also love dogs. So I will probably end up with a dog, and I dog sit for lots of people. But if it weren't for the allergy, I would have like 10 cats running around for sure.
Mm. Okay. Window or aisle?
Window, definitely.
All right. Favorite smell?
Favorite smell, coffee. Especially coffee grounds.
Well, you mentioned coffee earlier. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Star Wars or Star Trek?
Babylon 5.
Babylon 5. You're the third person that I've interviewed that likes Babylon 5.
Oh, Babylon 5. I mean, I like Star Trek. I like Star Wars. But Babylon 5 is, that's peak sci-fi for me.
Yeah, we had, I do a sci-fi podcast as well, and called Spockcast, and I had a friend on, Josh Rock, and he gave us a good 5 minutes on why Babylon 5 is an amazing series, so I think he tickled our interest on a few places, so.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a Bill Mumy fan from Lost in Space when I was a kid, so I've watched shows when he's been on, but I never really got into the sort of the whole arc of it, right? So
it's a great show. I actually rewatched it this year, and I used to tell people the first season was a little slow, Mm-hmm. But what I came to this rewatch, and it had been 5 or 6 years since I had seen it, what the conclusion I came to this year is not that the first season is slow. It's Babylon 5 as a mechanism. It tells dozens of stories interweaved together, and it takes mm-hmm. a while for all of those cast members to show up. So it's not that right. it's slow. It's just the tapestry is just starting to be put together at the beginning. So, and it can be a little cheesy. Yeah, it's a little campy, a little cheesy, but great story.
All right. Well, on that sort of thread, who's your favorite hero of fiction?
Hero of fiction? Silent Bob?
Okay. I'm right there with you. What number am I thinking of?
42.
No, so close. You were very close with the Silent Bob answer, but oh well, we'll move on. If you get the connection, you might understand
yes.
what that is. Have yep. you ever asked anybody for their autograph?
Yes. So I mentioned the VR Columbus earlier. When I first started going, there was an author who was coming to our meetups to study. He was looking into VR because he was writing a book that featured VR heavily in the subject matter. And he wrote this, it's a series called Shredded, Charles mm-hmm. O'Donnell. And he published the first book. I bought it on Amazon to support him. Then when he was writing the second book, he sent me a manuscript to read and get feedback on. And I had, I got to read the early version of that. As a thank you, he sent me an autographed copy. And then pandemic happened. Nobody saw anybody for a long time. Finally, when things got a little bit back to normal, he had released Volume 3. And we met up for lunch. And he gave me a signed copy of Volume 3. And I brought my original Volume 1. That I had bought on my own to say, hey, will you sign this? Now I've got the whole collection. So.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of getting authors to sign their books or going to mm-hmm. book signings. I don't know, this might be a stretch, but do you know who Marc Léonard is?
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the guys in the early, early PHP days who started a website where he explained how to install PHP and how to okay. do all that kind of stuff. And he and another gentleman wrote a book once, and I can't remember how I ended up, but they were going to send me one. And I said, I'll gladly accept the book as long as both of you sign the book.
Okay.
So the one gentleman was in the United States. He signed it. He had to ship it to Switzerland, where the other guy, Marc Léonard, lived, and have him sign it. And I got it back. It's one of these, PHP for Dummies books. Or, didn't really need it, but I have it signed. And I have a number of things. Mm-hmm. I have a Buzz Aldrin signed photograph behind me as well, which is cool. Yeah, some people don't collect them, but I think it's important to honor people's work.
Definitely.
What's the most used app on your phone?
Drafts.
Drafts?
Drafts.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned that in a thread today on Blue yeah. Sky, right?
Yeah, the Drafts app is like for me, it's a universal capture app. I mm-hmm. use it a lot on my Mac, but it's, if I'm unlocking my phone to say anything to anybody, it's probably going into Drafts first. So
what is it? So it's basically like a super note taker kind of idea, or?
So it can be a notes app. I use it more like a super inbox. So everything goes into Drafts and then out somewhere else. So either into an email, copy it out as Markdown, copy it out as HTML, send it. You can write these little JavaScript actions, so I can publish it to an API. I can send a copy directly to a WordPress backend as a draft there. I could submit a GitHub issue. I could, relatively boundless what you can do with it. And it's the most critical part of my computing infrastructure, to the point where when Vision Pro launched, Drafts was not available right away. He had unchecked the iPad compatibility version because he wanted to verify things that it would work. So in that two or three month period before he rechecked that box, I built my own clone of Drafts just for my own internal use that did the 5 or 6 things that I needed to do the most. And as soon as Agile Tortoise published Drafts for Vision Pro, which is not a native app, it's still just an iPad app, but once he did that, I kind of went back to his app. But yeah, it is, I pay $2 a month for it. And, I look at, paying like $30 a month for QuickBooks and, $15 a month for Microsoft Exchange. I'm like, why am I paying $2 for Drafts? Like, this is so much more valuable than what QuickBooks does for me.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So did you buy a yearly subscription or a lifetime license or something? Or
I don't know if he has a lifetime license. If he 10x the price, I would definitely keep subscribed. So.
Well, there you go. All right.
It's a good fantastic
advice for
product.
Him. Two more questions. Do you have a dream you remember?
Yeah. It's a really weird one.
Okay. We have time.
Okay. I think I had eaten really spicy food, and I had been watching Stargate a lot. And for some reason, in this dream, I was exploring the universe with some Stargate people, like SG-1 people. But also, we had a spaceship, kind of, and we landed on this planet that had these, like, steaming volcanoes everywhere, like, you know, about the size of, like, Termite Hill. And then we're just, like, exploring around kind of Star Trek, like, original series style, just like, you know, what's all this stuff? And then out of the volcanoes, this little tentacle comes out with, like, a baby attached to it that, like, screams at us and shoots lasers at us. Very disturbing, like, woke right up from that. I'm like, what was that? Like, I woke up from it and wrote it down. Like, wow, that was the strangest thing. Like, no idea what that was. I usually don't dream much anymore, but that one's always stuck with me.
Cool. All right. Describe the rest of your life in 5 words.
Trying to be useful.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, let's wrap it up here. So thanks for coming on the show. And if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you? What's the best way to get in touch with you? And so, what are you working on?
So I'm definitely working on Step In Division. My ambition for Step In Division is to make it the most useful place for VisionOS developers. Whether you're showing up from the existing Apple ecosystem, or you're coming from the VR ecosystem, or you're just a new developer, I want to have stuff there for everybody. So there's what you see on Step In Division today is a tiny infantile percent of what I want to make. There's going to be some big plans coming, so definitely keep an eye on the site. There's a newsletter, so it's just stepin2.vision is the website. You can follow me on Blue Sky, VR Hermit. I forget the exact string of characters.
I'll put a link in the show notes. I'll put a link in the video as well.
And then my LinkedIn, I believe, is still Radical App Dev. I'll post a link there. I'm also technically on X and Threads and Mastodon, but I'm putting most of my attention on Blue Sky and LinkedIn. So.
Cool. All right. Well, my name is Tim Mitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A, on most of the socials, including Blue Sky, Mastodon. You can find me on LinkedIn, but not with that handle. Until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at morethanjustcode.com. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends, leave a comment on the website, or write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag AskMTJC and we may mention you on the show. Friends of the show can also join us on the podcast Slack channel. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is @MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Every dollar pledged helps a lot. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Well, this is the after show, technically. But Ray Wenderlich started out very simply with a site where he just posted a few things about building apps for iOS. And that's how I found him. And then I met him a few years later at a conference in Denver. I introduced myself, and that's how I ended up becoming an author. But like I said, I remember when he got to the point with raywenderlich.com where he had to decide between being a freelance developer or going full-time with the site. So here's hoping that Step In Division is your sort of entryway into doing that, right?
Yeah, that's the idea. And that's why I did it as a separate site, sort of continuing to do it on my own site.
Right.
So I wanted to have something that is, it's mine, but it's not necessarily tied to my identity.
And it fits with your being useful motto as well, right?
Yep. So there are definitely, if you ever want to write anything for it, let me know. Collaborate on a series. I'm working with some people on some other stuff coming up.
January. I had an idea to do a VisionOS book too, but like I said, I'm a bit of a generalist anyway, so who knows, maybe a chapter or two might be coming your way to write.
Cool. Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, and I, like I said, I'm really a big fan of the work you're doing because it saves me time having to dig into a particular subject. Actually, one of the things I wanted to ask and thank you for is looking at the pivot point stuff, because I don't know if you're familiar with Alexander Calder. He built huge mobiles. They're like sculpture. Well, it's like, you know, it's like you have a couple of weights, and then there's another piece that comes up and another weight and another piece that comes off of that, and there's another weight, and it kind of just moves in the wind slowly. And there's one in Washington DC at the Smithsonian Art Place, where it's like huge atrium, and this big giant steel sculpture built by him is there, and it's probably the largest execution I've seen of that. And I'm trying to build one for VisionOS, and just, you know, to have something. Just that's one of my you know, fun projects, right? But mm-hmm. yeah, so yeah. But it requires understanding the pivot points, and I was trying to figure out whether you could do that in Reality Composer Pro, or it's all Reality Kit, or whatever, right? So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of weird, like, use Reality Composer Pro for this part of it, and then switch over to code for this part.
Yeah, yeah. No, I did take a quick peek at your lab. So yeah, definitely keep those up, and I'll be coming by and visiting every now and then, and spreading the word.
Awesome.
Cool. Well, great to meet you, and thanks for your time.